From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So on the campaign trail, President Obama said Donald Trump was not qualified to be America's president. Donald Trump led the birther movement, accusing Obama of not even being American. But today they met at the White House. Here's what Trump said afterwards, sitting next to President Obama in the Oval Office.
I very much look forward to dealing with the president in the future, including counsel. He's explained some of the difficulties, some of the high-flying assets, and some of the really great things that have been achieved. So, Mr. President, it was a great honor being with you, and I look forward to being with you many, many more times in the future. Thank you.
Well, joining us now, NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, where to start? First with maybe how long this meeting was.
Well, Donald Trump said that the meeting was scheduled to only run about 10 or 15 minutes, kind of a just get acquainted session, but it ran about 90 minutes, and it was, according to both participants, a substantive conversation. Donald Trump also said this was the first time these two men had ever actually met. Mm. They've been talking about each other for years, as you mentioned. They've been saying some nasty things on the campaign trail about one another. Not only did President Obama say that Trump was unfit to be commander-in-chief, but Donald Trump called Barack Obama one of the worst presidents in American history. So they were quite hostile in their exchanges during the campaign, but very much making nice today. And President Obama once again said his top priority for the next couple of months is to ensure a smooth transition to the incoming President Trump. He again said that he's rooting for Trump to be successful, because if he's successful, that means the country will be successful.
Well, we noted, too, when he said they hadn't met, and yet they have seen each other across a crowded dining room. We remember the 2011 White House Correspondents' Dinner when President Obama was speaking. Trump was in the audience, and Obama mocked Trump for leading the birther movement, you know, pressuring Obama into releasing his birth certificate to prove he was born in Hawaii in the U.S. Let's remember.
No one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing?
And you cut to a shot of Donald Trump. He was not laughing. And, you know, Scott, people are saying that's when the seed was planted. That's when Trump was fired up to run for president. And now he's sitting next to the president.
That's right. And President Obama has said throughout this campaign, Donald Trump's campaign, that he did not imagine that the American people were going to put Donald Trump in the Oval Office. But the American people did. And now these two men are talking about how to hand off the power of the office of the president.
You could not script this. Well, so baby steps. But how do you think, you know, from looking at how their body language was maybe, or how do you think it's going?
Well, it's in the interests of both of these men to make this a smooth transition. Not only was Donald Trump there meeting with President Obama, but Melania Trump came to the White House today, and Michelle Obama showed her around the residence. President Obama said that the Obamas want to make the Trumps feel welcome in what will be their home for the next 4 years. All of this is customary. This is not out of the ordinary for an outgoing president to offer this kind of counsel to an incoming president, even a president of the opposite party. And it's not uncommon after two terms to switch parties. But certainly the vitriol between these two men has been extraordinary. And so this now beginning of that peaceful transfer of power is extraordinary.
Well, and it seems, with a minute to go here, it seems even more important, as some Americans are taking to the street to protest the presidency, to ensure that it is a peaceful passing of power.
This is a two-minute warning for the president.
That's right. And forgive me, I'm speaking to you from the White House booth here.
It's so exciting. You got to go because something's happening in 2 minutes. We just wrap it up, Scott. In a couple seconds, we'll let you go.
Donald Trump also said today that he thinks of President Obama as a very good man, which is a change in tone for him as well.
Yeah. Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent, there at the White House being told to do something. Scott, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now that Donald Trump is president-elect, he'll have to put together a cabinet. One of the most important jobs is Secretary of State. And among the names reportedly being talked about are former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. No matter who gets the job, one of the biggest challenges will be Russia. At the Kremlin yesterday, Russian President Vladimir Putin congratulated Trump for his victory. Here he is speaking through a translator.
But Russia is ready and wants to restore the full-fledged relations with the United States.
Joining us now is Lucian Kim, who's going to be NPR's new Moscow correspondent. He's in Washington today. Hi, Lucian.
Hi.
Well, what do you make of President Putin's reaction to Donald Trump's victory?
Well, if I had to describe it in one word, I'd probably say conciliatory. And in some ways, it's a little bit surprising. I mean, the relations right now between the, Russia and the United States are truly in a crisis. Putin also did say that straight out, that it's in a crisis. And the words he also repeated were, he's ready to build relations as long as they're built on mutual respect. We keep on hearing this word respect and genuine consideration of each side's interests. Why it's surprising is because when Barack Obama won the election in 2008, there was a very different reaction from Moscow at the time. Dmitry Medvedev, who is Putin's protege, was president. And he reacted to Obama's election by saying he would station missiles that could have nuclear warheads on the Polish border. So it was a very different welcome this time to the incoming president.
Putin also said it's not our fault that relations are as bad as they are. Do you think Donald Trump agrees with that, that it's the United States' fault that relations between Russia and the U.S. are not good?
I do think that considering the kind of rhetoric we did hear from Donald Trump during the election campaign, I think that Donald Trump would probably partially agree with that. I mean, that is, grievances against the United States and the West in general are really driving Putin's foreign policy right now. And Trump has certainly made indications that he understands Russia's position in Ukraine, Syria, and in Europe, where Russia feels encircled by NATO.
Do you expect that Trump will try to ease the sanctions on Russia because of Russia's annexation of Crimea?
We don't know exactly, but Donald Trump did make noises during the summer that he understood annexation to be sort of a fait accompli that could no longer be reversed. And I think it really should be said that for Putin, probably the number one priority is to get the sanctions lifted. What is important to remember is the sanctions came about actually in two waves. First, after the annexation of Crimea in March 2014. And then there was sort of an epilogue to that conflict when Russia began supporting a rebellion in eastern Ukraine, which included later the tragic shootdown of a Malaysia Airlines airliner over the rebel area, which then kind of pushed for a second wave of sanctions. So we kind of have two sets of sanctions. These sanctions have been implemented by the European Union and the United States. And that unity between the United States and the European Union is very important. If that cracks, or if there are dissenting voices also within the European Union, which has 28 member nations, that could then create some waves, and then the momentum to keep the sanctions on Russia could break. So for Putin, that's very important.
Is it possible that Putin could try to take more territory if he thinks that Trump is okay with Crimea?
Well, this is the thinking in large parts of Eastern Europe that were under Soviet influence. Their concern is that if the West simply accepts the annexation of Crimea, says, well, you know, Ukraine isn't going to get it back, too bad, let's get on with things and move forward. The concern is that that will basically be a green light to Putin to expand further. Whether those fears are justified, we, of course, don't know, but that certainly is a very real fear.
What about Syria? Obviously, the U.S. and Russia both involved in the fight in Syria, but they've got different interests. The Russians are in support of President Assad. The U.S. has been less so, although they haven't taken steps to oust him at this point. But what might happen when it comes to Syria?
It's really hard to tell, again, what might happen. We've heard different things. But during the summer, Donald Trump did say that, hey, why don't we team up with the Russians and fight ISIS in Syria? And this has been sort of Putin's line ever since Russia entered the conflict in Syria a little more than a year ago. Putin went to the United Nations and he said, guys, we need to make an international coalition very similar to the coalition that defeated Hitler in World War II. This is the same kind of threat, and we want to be on the same team and go after these guys. And the way Putin is spinning it back home is that the West is not serious about fighting terrorism, and that's why Russia has to go its own way.
That's Lucian Kim, NPR's incoming Moscow correspondent, joining us today from Washington. Lucian, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Lots of topics to discuss, and we will be discussing them as we look forward to the next administration in the White House. What does it mean for us and other countries? Anti-Trump protesters took to the streets around the country last night in cities including Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, St. Paul, and more. In Los Angeles, part of the 101 highway was shut down. Here was some of the scene in New York where protesters descended on Trump Tower. Students were also out protesting, like these at the University of Connecticut in stores. So a lot of disappointment from Democrats following Donald Trump's win. David Korn is Washington Bureau Chief of Mother Jones. He joins us now. And David, what do you think about these protests and what do they say to you?
Well, first, I'm hoping that everybody who protested went out and voted against Donald Trump if they're now protesting the election of Donald Trump. We have a situation where I would argue that the most divisive presidential candidate in modern times has won an election and is going to take office having not won a majority of the vote, who has made statements that his own party leaders called racist, statements that have been misogynistic. He's called for a ban on Muslims, and yet he did not win the support for this dark vision from most voters. He won the majority of electoral college votes, but not the popular vote. So I can understand why people are upset, and while now they have no choice but to, you know, protest the way they're doing, but eventually they're going to have to organize and win electorally in the by-elections 2 years from now and then the next presidential election.
Well, a couple of things I want to get to there that you just mentioned. But first of all, it sounds like you think that some of the people who were out in the streets last night didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. Do you think that there are a lot of people who maybe they were Bernie Sanders supporters, maybe they decided to vote for Jill Stein or not vote, and they're the people who are out in the streets?
I don't know. I have not canvassed them. I have not done a survey. I'm just, you know, speculating. But I would say, and I had talked during the campaign season to Bernie Sanders supporters, I had a fair number of them on my Twitter feed who said they weren't going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Now, these were people who knew that Bernie Sanders had said that Donald Trump would be dangerous for the country. Therefore, he wanted his own supporters to vote for Hillary Clinton. So if they're out there protesting now and they had not followed Bernie's lead and voted for Hillary Clinton, then it's really too little too late for them in particular.
So what about the issue of the popular vote in the Electoral College? This is going to be the second time, it looks like, that a Democratic candidate has not won the presidency while winning the popular vote just in the last couple of decades. What are Democrats doing wrong that they have all of these people voting for them, and yet they, at this point, are about to have no power in the White House, Senate, or the Congress?
And what you're leaving out here is in the last congressional election, the Democrats won more votes nationally for House seats than did the Republicans. Well, I think it's time to look at the system. I mean, you asked what the Democrats did wrong. Now, of course, we can say Hillary should have won Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and everything would be right. But we need to, I think, revisit the need for the Electoral College. And we need also particularly to look at how Republicans, once they've gained control of state legislatures, have gerrymandered America to such an extent that the experts who look at this say that the Democrats would have to win 54% of the national House vote in order to win a majority in the House. Now, that is just patently unfair. Now, I know, Democrats have gerrymandered in the past as well, but I think it's time to stop that. You know, our country has developed demographically in a way that, you know, large numbers of people from certain groups are, you know, concentrated in urban areas and suburban areas, and their political power, you can even say their political rights, are being diluted by these, you know, old systems, you know, that were created hundreds of years ago, and by Republican gerrymandering. And let's not forget that Republicans have made a very, very conscious effort to reduce the number of voting places in areas that primarily serve African-American and Latino voters. In North Carolina and other key battleground states, scores, if not hundreds, of ballot places that once were open were closed. So I can understand why particularly first-time voters and younger folks say, wait a second, here comes Donald Trump with a campaign really, really full of a lot of hate and resentment and fear-mongering, and we didn't support him. In fact, most Americans didn't support him, but yet he's going to control the government in league with a Congress that, again, does not reflect the political leanings of Americans across the land.
What do you think the Democrats' first move should be right now if they want to stop Trump from doing the things that he said he's going to do?
Well, the Democrats did pick up seats in the Senate. And these days we hear, you know, Republicans saying, oh, you got to give Donald Trump a chance. We know on inauguration night, Republicans met in Washington to plot how to stop Obama. So Democrats here now, they will have the ability to filibuster in the Senate, and I don't think they should do it willy-nilly and anything. I think that Republicans ill-serve this country by not working with Obama on economic measures and climate change measures, things that our country need to deal with, and sort of filibustered and blocked him across the board. I think Democrats should look at what he's going to push through or try to push through and, you know, take one item at a time. If he wants to work, he said he wanted to do infrastructure. And Obama and the Democrats have been trying to do a big infrastructure bill as a jobs bill and to improve the nation's infrastructure for years now. And the Republicans is just one more thing that they say no to. So if he comes forward and says, OK, let me work together on this, I think they should work with him. They shouldn't just block him blindly the way Republicans try to do with Obama. But if he comes in and says he wants to have a deportation force, as he talked about during the campaign, and start breaking up millions of families, well, I think that's something that is worth fighting for from the Democratic side.
That's David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones. David, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, remember Hurricane Matthew, which walloped Haiti in October? The Miami-based Haitian-American Hurricane Matthew relief effort spent nearly a week in Haiti providing medical care, and they're going back tomorrow. Rowan Moore Garrity from Here Now contributor WLRN has this report from the first trip.
Planning for the trip started some 600 miles away in Miami with a late-night Facebook post as Hurricane Matthew forecast shifted east from Jamaica towards Haiti.
I was basically laying in bed and I thought to myself, we are so not going to have a repeat of the earthquake.
Sandy Dorsonville was in charge of trip logistics. She and other Haitian Americans were determined not to be sidelined as they felt they were after Haiti's catastrophic earthquake in 2010.
We didn't feel our power, I think, at that time. We felt like we needed to make room for those with bigger pockets and bigger efforts to make, you know, to solve the problem.
The South Florida chapter of the Haitian American Nurses Association led the medical part of the mission. They've done work like this in Haiti for more than 15 years. In a makeshift health clinic in the town of Camperin, nurse Marsha Eloi asks a grandmother in a blue headscarf how long she's been in pain. Eloi takes off a blood pressure cuff and tells her, it seems like your pressure is high. Asked when she last went to the doctor, the woman says, I don't have any money. Down the hall, Eliette Silver calls out to a fellow nurse in a primary school classroom that's been scrubbed clean and repurposed as a pharmacy.
Nancy, we have Protonix right here. Good for the stomach.
Leftover medication donated by organizations in South Florida has been meticulously alphabetized and sorted by dose in large Ziploc bags.
Now, this I'm not sure of. I'm fed up.
Outside, volunteers pray and sing with the people who had come for a checkup. They serve up home-cooked rice and beans. Again, Sandy Dorsonville.
It was important to us that there was just some sense of normalcy in that day for them, and the hot meal was part of that.
Some 600 people had gotten numbered tickets for a medical checkup, but by mid-afternoon, fewer than 200 had been seen. A group of women with tickets in the 500s wonders, are they going to have time for everyone?
We realize that we need to do things better each day.
That first night, Dr. Marie Etienne facilitated a meeting with the volunteers, an unflinching SWOT analysis, looking at strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. One thing that came up was the lack of coordination with the coalition's partnership network of Haitian churches hosting the relief effort. Here's volunteer James Pierre.
Because we were not the one giving the tickets, so many of the pastors, you know, friends and family comes in without tickets, and then people waiting for hours, you have five or six people coming in, sit right up front, and then now you have other people start saying, oh, what about me? Then
you can imagine how difficult this was. Coming in for a few days, they tapped into their partner's strengths and inherited some blind spots. During the day, one Catholic man said he thought the mission couldn't help him because it was organized by Baptist churches. Volunteers also had disagreements about two armed security guards on the mission.
If they're not there with the gun, that crowd that you saw today would have been more out of control.
I don't think that's what she meant. First of
all, the bottom line was clear for Sandy Dorsonville.
But very much, it's very important to me, just personally doing this type of work, that people leave the situation with their dignity.
They made some changes with that goal in mind. And on the second and third day of the mission, things ran more smoothly. Another mission is scheduled this week for areas in and around Jérémy, a town devastated by Hurricane Matthew. For Here and Now, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Before the election, a lot of people thought that Donald Trump's election would be bad for the markets. In fact, on election night, the stock market, the futures, were down significantly. But yesterday, the Dow jumped 256 points, and it's up again by a lot today. Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
So can you explain this? What's happening?
Yeah. So Trump, in his victory speech, was very conciliatory. There's been a peaceful transfer of power. And so while the international stock markets initially reacted with surprise to this surprise election result, the fact is that that did have a stabilizing effect on the markets. And everybody realized that, look, there's going to be a Republican president. There's going to be a Republican-controlled Congress. There's going to be a conservative court, too. And so that means that things are going to happen. Tax cuts are going to come. There's going to be increased government spending on infrastructure. And so there are immediate places for investors to turn to act on that.
Well, when you actually dig down which stocks are doing well that are driving these averages like the Dow up.
Yeah, financial, defense, and engineering companies sort of led the stock rally. Beth Comstock, she's the vice chair of GE, said yesterday that her company stock was up because they think that, you know, there's a big transportation division there, that they're going to have a get more business from increased U.S. government spending on infrastructure. Hmm. Caterpillar, last time I looked, its stock price was up $10 since the election. But it's really industry by industry, because even in healthcare, hospital company stocks are down. If tens of millions of Americans lose affordable care, then hospitals lose customers. But pharmaceutical companies, their stocks are way up because they feel like there's going to be less regulation and they may be able to charge more for drugs.
What about Silicon Valley? It looks like some of the tech stocks, Amazon and Facebook, not doing so well.
Yeah, so Trump has called in the past for antitrust action against Amazon. He has said that Apple should be forced to make all of their products in the United States. He once called for a boycott of Apple. There are also companies with a lot of data worried that the U.S. government is going to seize more of that, be more aggressive about snooping into customers' lives. And while that may not affect business in the U.S., a lot of global customers, if they feel like the U.S. government is going to be looking at their emails, may not want to use Gmail. So that is putting a dampening effect on Silicon Valley stocks. And one investor there even called for California to secede from the United States.
I'm somehow doubting that's going to happen. But there's also a sell-off right now in government bonds. What's happening there?
Yeah, basically, bond prices go down when yields go up. And the expectation is if the U.S. government borrows more money to build more roads and bridges, that investors, people who loan money to the U.S. are going to demand higher returns.
It's interesting because a lot of Democrats, and we heard it from David Corn, have been calling for infrastructure spending. And this is one of the first things that President-elect Trump has said that he wants to do is spend a lot of money on infrastructure. And they've said you can borrow very cheaply right now, which will make it easier to buy those materials.
Right. A Republican in the White House, Republicans in Congress.
That's Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Kurt, thanks so much.
You got it.
When Ronald Reagan first came into office in 1981, one of his first orders, remove the 32 solar panels installed on the White House by his predecessor Jimmy Carter, setting back the awareness of climate change decades. So what will the President Donald Trump do on the energy front? He once said in a tweet that climate change was a hoax perpetrated by China. And there are reports today in Politico and other places that Trump has chosen a leading climate change denier to lead the transition in the Environmental Protection Agency. Stephanie Joyce is a reporter for Here Now contributor Inside Energy. So, Stephanie, start with the report that Trump has chosen Myron E. Bell of the Conservative Competitive Enterprise Institute to lead the EPA team.
Yeah, so Ebel has really been described in the past frequently as the climate change denier in chief. And that's apparently a title that he relishes. He's criticized basically everything the Obama administration has done on energy and the environment. And I think he would presumably push for Trump to reverse as many of those decisions as possible. And, you know, he might have quite a bit of power to do that. In addition to being the transition team lead for the EPA, Ebel's name is at the top of the list to actually head up the EPA.
Yeah. Well, we know that Steve Bannon, Trump's campaign manager, came from Breitbart News, which is crowing today about this. Yup, greenies, that climate change gravy train you've been riding on looks like it's headed for a crash. And Ebel has said President Obama's decision to sign the Paris Climate Accord was unconstitutional. Trump has said he'd back out of it. Here he is in May speaking at a petroleum conference in North Dakota.
We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop. Unbelievable. And stop all payments of the United States tax dollars to UN global warming programs.
Stephanie, start there. How easy would it be for Donald Trump to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Treaty?
It would be extremely easy for him to withdraw. He could simply not meet the terms of the agreement, and then the U.S. would effectively no longer be a party. You know, but he would face immense international pressure if he decided to do that. China took the rare step during the election of actually speaking out on Trump's stated goal of withdrawing from the Paris Agreement. And you can bet they would be very, very unhappy if the U.S. actually did that. Whether that will stop him, you know, who knows? And if the U.S. does pull out of the agreement, it's hard to say whether it will simply fall apart, or whether other countries like China and India, who have their own reasons for wanting to combat climate change, including just unbelievable pollution problems, might decide to take the lead. Or, you know, it could fall apart, and that would put the world on track for catastrophic levels of global warming. You know, sort of more immediately, I think what Trump will certainly do is back out of the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan. That was President Obama's signature climate change rule, which would have dramatically reduced greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector. And, you know, gutting that would mean that emissions from the power sector, which has historically been the country's largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, would probably rise in the long term. You know, that said, the Clean Power Plan wasn't scheduled to go into effect until 2022, and carbon emissions have been dropping from the power sector in recent years, you know, as utilities have been switching from coal to natural gas and renewables. And since utility decisions are typically made on a much longer time horizon than a single presidency, I wouldn't expect those decisions to change quickly. So it's probably not likely that we'll see a huge uptick in emissions from the power sector in the near future either way.
Well, but Donald Trump said as well that he'd bring back coal jobs. How realistic is this? Coal production is declining in part because of the economics. I mean, we have cheaper gas.
Yeah, I mean, in short, it's going to be very difficult for him to bring back coal jobs. Trump made huge promises to coal miners about their job prospects under his administration, and a lot of miners voted for him because of that. But keeping those promises is going to be extremely difficult. I spoke yesterday with University of Wyoming economist Rob Godby. Let me play you a little bit of that tape.
Big issue for coal is not regulation. You know, coal companies may tell themselves that, but the real issue is markets. The real problem is since 2008, we've got lots of natural gas, and it's just cheaper and cleaner to burn natural gas to make electricity than it is to burn coal.
You know, Trump has said that he wants to open up public lands for more oil and gas development, which would presumably, you know, increase natural gas production. That would create even more competition for coal. So, you know, unless Trump plans to kill natural gas, it's hard to see how he plans to bring back coal jobs.
Well, we started by talking about Ronald Reagan taking down solar panels, which some said set back the solar industry. But the solar industry seems to be doing well now. It would seem a President Trump, a businessman, would he go after the solar and wind industry?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, he hasn't explicitly opposed renewables, but he has called them ugly and dangerous. I would not expect to see the same kind of support for renewables that the Obama administration has shown. But I also would not expect to see him directly go after renewables. Renewable energy prices have come down enormously in recent years. The industry is a huge economic driver in some parts of the country. So if he's promoting a platform of economic growth, I think it would be probably an unwise decision to try and kill renewables.
That's Stephanie Joyce, Energy and Natural Resources reporter for Wyoming Public Radio. Stephanie, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as we just heard, Donald Trump has pledged to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement signed last year by President Obama and nearly 200 other countries. Negotiators are ironing out the details of that accord this week in Marrakesh, Morocco, and they're coming to grips with what a Trump presidency might mean for the international climate deal. Reporter Daniel Grossman has more from the meeting.
Smoke carrying the aroma of grilled lamb wafts above crowds in Marrakesh's famed old city. Musicians pluck banjo-like gimbris and beat drums. Dancers twirl. At the climate meeting, not far away, the mood is less festive. At a hastily arranged news conference several hours after the election was called, Alden Meyer, a veteran climate activist from the U.S.-based Union of Concerned Scientists, reacted to the results.
It's clear that Donald Trump is about to be one of the most powerful people in the world, but even he does not have the power to amend and change the laws of physics, to stop the impacts of climate change, to stop the rising sea levels.
2015 was the world's hottest year since measurements began. 2016 promises to break records again. Scientists predict catastrophe if the world doesn't act decisively and soon. Activists here expressed fear that Donald Trump will delay a response. In public, they're putting on a brave face.
All hope is not lost.
Jesse Bragg heads Media Affairs for Corporate Accountability International.
We have been here before, not necessarily in a Trump presidency, but with the threat of the U.S. pulling out of agreements. And this process has overcome that. And I think we can do that once more.
Activists and climate experts say it would be hard for President Trump to pull out of the Paris Agreement. Technically, it's part of the Rio Agreement, signed by George H.W. Bush and ratified by the U.S. Senate nearly 25 years ago. But Maya Golden Krasner, an attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, says that as president, Trump could find ways to sabotage it.
He could just not move forward with the agreement, not fund the agreement, not fund domestically the EPA.
Without U.S. funding and fossil fuel cutbacks, other countries might also change course, leading to a collapse of the fragile international consensus. Golden Krasner is already making plans to forestall such an event.
We will be filing lawsuits, I'm sure, against the federal government, and looking also really to other countries to pressure President-elect Trump into moving forward with this agreement.
Diplomats here are responding more diplomatically. In a press release, Salahdin Meswar, the chair of this year's conference, congratulated Trump on his victory. "We are convinced that all parties will respect their commitments and stay the course in this collective effort," he said. For Here and Now, I'm Daniel Grossman, reporting from Marrakesh, Morocco.
Well, 2016 has been a big year for environmental agreements. Last month, governments signed the first ever deal to cut carbon emissions from planes. Airlines agreed to fund wind farms and solar power plants to offset the future growth of the industry. Those reductions will phase in over several years. And also in October, diplomats meeting in Rwanda agreed to phase out hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry called that agreement a monumental step forward.
And now to the media's role in this election. Lots of newsroom hand-wringing about being shocked at a Donald Trump win, a marker of just how bad a job we did, says Joshua Benton at the Nieman Journalism Lab. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has some thoughts. Hi, David.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. And we're going to post your column, "Trump Won, the Media Lost, What's Next?" at herenow.org. But start with media lost. Look, some of us did say it was a distinct possibility, but we are not pundits. You say the media pundits swung and missed. Tell us more.
Oh, my gosh. They swung and it's like they swung three times and missed on this one. If you look at the pollsters, there were so many states that were considered in the bank for Hillary Clinton going in that she lost on election night. If you look at places like The Upshot, they gave her in, I think, the day before the election about an 85% chance Hillary Clinton of winning and said it was about equivalent to missing a 37-yard field goal for a good NFL kicker. It happens, but doesn't happen much. Well, that kicker sure shanked wide. This was, you know, when I talk to media executives, as I have, when I talk to anchors and reporters in the field, they are shocked. I mean, they are genuinely shocked. You can't fake the degree to which they are surprised by what happened. The polls told them one thing and they conditioned reporting very much, framing their reports to us, the audience, as a result of what they believed the polls were showing.
Well, look, there's criticism of the polls. And as we mentioned earlier in the program, there's always the Cubs. You know, they also had the same stats as Donald Trump did. But putting the polls aside, or actually putting the polls front and center, are reporters not getting out enough to talk to people themselves to see that there are a few signs? Are they depending too much on the polls?
You know, I think that there is a lot of reporting that is used to build on polls to say, well, let's get at the texture of that. And then they interview people to fill in the slots that the polls have told them exist, right? And so I think that there's sort of almost a preconditioning of this is how things actually are, and therefore our reporting will illustrate that. I don't think it's fair to say that reporters didn't go, as I think some critics have said, to Rust Belt parts of the country, to places where particularly disaffected whites who have been hit hard by not only the economy, economies tanking almost a decade ago, but really the question of shifts in how the economy works, the mechanization of so much manufacturing and other trends, and that we didn't talk to those people in the press. I think we did. I think you heard them in NPR. I think you saw them in the pages, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. You saw them on CNN. And yet, you know, those weren't the only people who turned out for Donald Trump.
Right.
And a lot of it also was the question of who did it and did not turn out for Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump got a stronger support among white women than I think a lot of pollsters expected. Donald Trump consistently, you know, showed more support among the affluent than the coverage I think would indicate. So while there are voices that supported Trump or believed in his what he had to say, I think there are ways in which they didn't capture that. I also wanted to just offer one thought which I thought was really interesting and telling. There's this conservative political columnist who used to work for a Pittsburgh newspaper. Her name is Selena Zito. She's been going all over in her car talking to voters. And she concluded in a piece she wrote in September, "The press takes Trump literally but not seriously. His supporters take him seriously but not literally." That is, we focused on the outrageous implications of a lot of what he said in the press because they are severe and significant. But his reporters say, we think that he won't build a wall necessarily or toss out 11 million people here in this country without legal status. But we think he'll do more about that issue. That was not something really reflective reflected in the press. They took literally what he had to say.
Well, what else do you think is at play here? Because it reminds me of when Scott Brown took Ted Kennedy's Senate seat here in Boston. If you were listening to right-wing radio at the time, you knew that he was going to win. But if you were in your own media bubble, you didn't. And I'm thinking that it's kind of ironic because conservative writers, Russ Douthat, was shouting, you know, criticism of Donald Trump. You had Charlie Sykes and Glenn Beck on the radio. But you may not have, you know, heard that if you were in your own media bubble.
Well, think of what you just said. You said if you listened to conservative radio, right of center radio, you would have known that Scott Brown
because he was
off
on
Kennedy's
it all the time.
Because
right.
he was on it all the
yeah.
time. And you wouldn't have heard it if you were in your media bubble. The funny thing is the media thinks of itself as a place that bursts the bubble, yeah. of a place that, you know, without fear or favor goes and finds out what the facts are and find out what the latter truth of and presents that to the broader public. And many, particularly on the right, but increasingly on the left, see the press as in its own bubble. And the mm-hmm. way it occurs is that they look at the press and they say, you know what, you're part of this great establishment party that's been going on that we're not a part of. You guys are all chattering in studios for cable TV and having a great time yelling at each other, and we know you're slapping each other's backs after the fact. And all of you believe in the idea ultimately that, you know what, if Hillary Clinton, you know, maybe she's getting hundreds of thousands of dollars to go speak to Wall Street firms, but ultimately she's representing kind of a bit more of the common man. Maybe. And actually, that's not how a lot of voters responded to that.
Yeah.
That they took that as a more serious issue than people who live perhaps in New York as I do or Washington otherwise do.
Dave, you just got a minute here. But candidate Trump talked about loosening libel laws to make it easier to sue the press. He called out reporters like Katie Turr of NBC at his rallies. She needed escorts for her own safety.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think a President Trump is going to be with the media? Just briefly.
Well, and don't forget, he's threatened to sue the New York Times. He suggested to Fox News in May he might go after Jeff Bezos and Amazon for basically antitrust or concentration of power because Bezos personally owns the Washington Post. Both newspapers had reported critically about Trump, and he didn't like it at all. I think we're going to have to wait and see. You know, he does love press attention. He seems to wither without it. And we're going to have to see if the press can rely on his ego and in some ways insincerity in some of the rhetoric he's adopted against the press in the past.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenglick just starting this conversation about the press and Donald Trump. David, thank you.
You bet.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.